This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. It is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you for the next 50-some minutes till 2 p.m. when Jimmy Accardi brings us his rock and roll party. I sometimes say we have very similar or dissimilar authors who I'll be talking with on this program. There couldn't be any two more dissimilar than the two whom I interviewed earlier this morning. The first is Tobias Wolff, who's best known probably for his memoir, This Boy's Life, but has also written three or four. He's written a second memoir in Pharaoh's Army, a novella with a barracks thief, a novel, Old School, and four or five volumes of short stories. And that may be his best known work, the memoirs and short stories. He's just come out with a new and selected stories called This Our Story Begins. He'll be speaking at the California Lectures Series at the Crest Theater in Sacramento a week from Thursday. That's Thursday, the 8th of May at 7:30 p.m. I say he'll be speaking, but it's actually a conversation with Pam Houston, who teaches at UC Davis and is also a well-known story writer. You'll see as you listen to the interview that for Wolff, the final effect of the story, the emotional, aesthetic, moral effect of the story is the most important thing. Plot is only what gets you there. In the second half of the program, I'll be talking with David Ambrose, whose first novel, The Man Who Turned Into Himself, has just been reissued by Picador Books. He has a number of other books. I'll talk about them a little later. For him, the plot is everything, and it's important for the plot to be as complicated and twisty as possible. But let's start with Tobias Wolff. He's going to talk for about a little over 20 minutes. Then I'm going to play one of his best-known stories, and finally we'll talk with David Ambrose. I've noticed that almost all the stories in Our Story Begins have a very, very specific physical location. You either know exactly what street you're on in what city, or at least you know what part of the country you're in and what the closest big city might be. Uh-huh. Is this intentional, or is it just the way you write?
Well, you know, by the time I've written the last draft of the story, everything is intentional in it. You know, when I spend, as I typically do, say, a couple months, sometimes even 3 months or so, of writing a short story draft after draft, there's very little in there that has escaped my notice. And so, you know, things like location and, you know, the nature of the characters, the things that the story brings to the surface, I certainly hope are intentional.
What do you normally begin with? A character, a situation, a mood?
It really could, a story can start with any of those things and more. Sometimes it'll be a line of music that'll take me back through the years to a situation that I will then, you know, but upon this very slender foundation of memory, invent a story that after the story is done, one could only with difficulty trace to the original inspiration for it. And that's, I think, probably the case with most of these stories. However they began, the original intention or inspiration for the story often gets lost in the thoughts that occur to me as I'm writing and rewriting the story.
And I notice that very often the characters are in very ambiguous situations. They don't know which way to turn. They can be indecisive, or events can be bearing down on them. And they frequently end up very inconclusively, that all of the events have happened and the characters still aren't quite sure what's going on.
You mean unlike us, who always know exactly what's going on?
I'm thinking of The Benefit of the Doubt.
Oh, I think The Benefit of the Doubt has a kind of moral conclusiveness to it, a kind of conclusiveness in a level of self-knowledge and self-recognition that the character Malin achieves in it.
He's apprehended a pickpocket. He's befriended him. He's gone back to his house.
He hasn't befriended him. He's taken responsibility for him. That's a very different thing. He's injured the man, and he recognizes that he has, and he's trying to do the right thing by taking him home. This leads to a bit of a disaster for him, as he ends up losing his wallet after all, as those who try to act compassionately may well do. But he's also recognized the limits of his own fragility, if you will, in this world, and has discovered a kind of gratitude that he is very well insulated from the kinds of disasters that can strike most of the people in the world. He can simply call up his company and be issued with an entire new set of credit cards, identification, passports, and he will once again assume his privileged place in the world, whereas most people in that situation would be really lost, to have forfeited their identity, their money, even their proof of who they are. It would be a disaster for most people in this world. And he fancies himself something of an altruist and a lover of the common man, but he is forced to recognize through this set of circumstances that he is irrevocably entangled with his own privilege, and that he, in fact, is very glad to have it. So the story reaches a conclusion in terms of the man's self-recognition, and that's what stories are really about. They're not about plot. The events of the story can lead people to either reject or to accept some new vision of life or of themselves, but unlike a kind of fantasy novel where everything gets shut down in the end and all answers are given to all questions, I don't think the best short stories do that, and I don't even think the best novels do that.
There are some stories that, given a different time and circumstances, and I'm thinking of ones like Desert Breakdown or The Other Miller or Two Boys and a Girl, could almost have appeared in a more sophisticated Saturday Evening Post, because the plot is sort of what drives it. But there's something, I know that if the Saturday Evening Post existed these days, it would never publish them.
I guess that's true. Things happen. And stories are stories. Something has to happen in them, and to some extent that will compel the reader's interest. But I'm mainly interested in story as what arises from the interaction of characters. I wouldn't want to construct plot like it's some sort of, those old Arthur Murray studio correspondence courses for dance, where you'd roll out a piece of paper and there were all these little footprints on it, and they'd give you a record and you were to put your feet in these places as the music progressed to learn how to do the cha-cha or the rumba, and some people, I think, conceive stories like that, that you you have this very firm design, and then you make the character step in these various footprints through the story. The problem with that is that your people can end up simply looking like automata going through a drill. You should always have the sense of unpredictability in a story, even if there's also, when the characters do what they do, also a sense of, oh yeah, that's just what that person would have done. But you shouldn't know it in advance. And that's the problem with a very too firmly designed story where plot reigns supreme and the characters simply become the creatures of the plot. The character should be giving rise to the story, not the other way around.
I think of a lot of the stories in the book as involving moral conflicts, and other ones, there is a conflict somewhere in the background, but there's a sort of aesthetic resolution, like in Next Door or Say Yes. Well, that's not quite resolved, but those are ones of couples having discussions or seeing things going on about them that puzzle them, and they don't know quite how to deal with what's puzzling them, and in the end they just sort of come together, and you, at least I as a reader, hope that it's been resolved.
Well, to take the case of Say Yes, that's a story in which a husband and wife argue about whether or not white people should marry black people, and the husband takes the position that they should not because of the differences in background, culture, even language, and insists that a person from their culture and a person from white culture could never really know each other, and his wife is offended by the husband's presumption that he knows her, which he thinks he does, through and through. And also, of course, by the conditional nature of his love, to realize that, you know, if she'd been black, he wouldn't have married her. By the end of the story, the husband has come to understand that that in fact he doesn't know his wife all the way through. That there is something mysterious there, and there's a kind of almost renewal of their marriage through that recognition of his at the end. It's like their first night together, and so there is, you know, there is a kind of awakening. It's very understated, because, you know, that's how it is. We tend not to have melodramatic awakenings, but we change and open our eyes by degrees in this life, and I think the story really reflects, I think the story form can really reflect those incremental changes in us in a very nuanced and indeed sometimes a very exact way, and that's, I hope, what that story achieves.
Aside from your stories, best known for your memoirs, This Boy's Life and In Pharaoh's Army, how many of the stories come from parts of your own life? I would say, having read through them, there are only a couple, maybe Firelight and Powder, that connect with what I know of your life, and the others seem to be imaginings of other people's lives, or are there things I'm missing?
Well, you aren't missing anything, and indeed, I think you've made assumptions about those two stories. I invented those stories. They're not autobiographical.
Uh-huh.
They are based on certain kind of dynamics in my own family and on characters from which I've drawn fictional characters, but neither of those things actually happened, and that's, you know, people have asked me from time to time about this or that story. Well, why didn't you put that in your memoir? The simple reason is that it didn't happen. I know that it didn't happen. The reader wouldn't know. You obviously didn't know, and I understand why you would make those assumptions. But we do have to pay attention to little things like labels, like nonfiction and fiction, and writers especially, I think, are obliged to pay attention to them. A lot of writers have grown very cavalier, as we know, about about calling their fictions memoirs, and it's sometimes it's amusing, like when this woman Misha de Fonseca in Europe published a memoir in which she claimed to have been raised by wolves during World War II, and I mean, one can only laugh at the credulity of the readers who trusted this narrative and professed shock to discover that she was not, in fact, raised by wolves. But the general abuse of the reader's trust like that has an unfortunate effect on the relationship between writers and readers, and it's one that I don't myself care to abuse any further by pretending that my fictions are memoirs. And so, if I call something a short story or a novel, it's a fiction. My novel Old School, for example, a lot of people have assumed, because there are certainly a lot of parallels between the narrator's life and mine, that I've changed a great many things as well, that's actually a memoir that I'm simply calling a novel. But no, there are things, especially in the interior life of the narrator of that novel, that are very similar to things that I went through and thought at that age. But in fact, the decisive events of that novel are fictional. So, I think it's really important for both readers and writers to keep the difference between these things pretty clearly in mind.
Your first published fiction was a novel, which you've now disowned. Then you turned to stories and memoirs. Old School was, I guess, the first novel which you...
I published a novel called The Barrack Thief, a short novel, back in...
Right.
84.
I think of Old School as being one of the best novels I've read in the last 5 years.
Oh, thank you.
I know you're working on a new one. Have you found yourself maybe moving more in the direction of novels and less in the way of memoirs or stories?
I can't at this moment imagine another memoir, but then I never imagined myself writing a memoir. I was kind of taken by surprise by the material that forced itself on me in writing This Boy's Life, and after publishing that, I said never again. That's awesome. That sense of privacy that was involved in the writing of that. And then I ended up writing another one. So you never can predict the pressures of certain material on you. So I better not say never, but I don't have any memoirs in mind at this point. And I do have a lot of stories that I want to write. That's why I didn't do a kind of complete or collected stories, but just did a provisional gathering of my stories, selected stories in this volume with 10 new ones. The field is certainly open, as it has been for others who've done these selected stories, people like William Trevor and Alice Munro, two writers whom I particularly admire, have both at some point along the way, and Raymond Carver as well, put out books of new and selected stories, leaving the road open to other volumes, and I certainly plan to write more stories. I have them in my mind, and I have this other book that I'm playing out in my that I'm writing now. So, all roads are open at this point, and I would love to write a play someday as well. I like writing dialogue, and I would like to see how much I can do with it.
You say it takes about 3 months to, on average, to write a story. How long does it take?
Generally speaking. Mm-hmm.
How about a novel?
Well, the very short novel I wrote, The Barrack Thief, that took a couple of years, and that's only 110 pages, and those are pages with pretty generous margins. In fact, one of my sons likes to say that when he picks my books up, they always look like books of poetry to him, because there's so much margin and so much space between the lines. And Old School took me 5 years from the time I put the first words on paper until, you know, I got the galleys back from the publisher. So I'm slow. Of course, I did write a few stories along the way while I was writing Old School as well. And I wish I were one of these writers through whom the writing seems to course like a river, and you're simply transcribing almost like Mozart did his music. But I'm one of these writers who seems to have to bang his head against the wall to make a dent in it.
You said in an interview I've seen before to the question of can writing be taught, you said simply no. But you do teach writing.
No, I don't teach writing. I lead workshops to undergraduates and to our Steger Fellows at Stanford. What you can help people do is to become very good editors of their own work and to develop a kind of steely detachment toward their own work as much as possible, because that's the only way you're really going to be able to improve, is to be able to look at what you've written and imagine ways of making it better. Very few people, nobody I've ever known certainly, can write a perfect rough draft. But typically, when we first begin writing, we're rather sentimentally attached to that rough draft, and we hate to change it. Again and again, that's what I hear from young writers, is that, I hate to rewrite, and I have this this thought always that you're not going to write. If you hate to rewrite, you will not take it to the next step, and the first step is rarely where you really want to be. You don't want to stay there. You always want to be taking your writing taking it deeper, setting a higher standard always for the next draft of the story. And in order to do that, you really have to learn how to be an editor of your own work and to look at it as if someone else had written it. And that I can help people do. I can also acquaint them with those families of writers whose work, if they read it closely, will be of great help to them in developing their own talent, their own art. So there are all kinds of ways in which I can help someone. The one thing I cannot do is put talent into them. And in that sense, no, you can't teach someone to write. You can help them become a better writer. That's about it.
Can you stop someone who's determined to write from writing?
Why would you want to do that? Life will stop them if they don't have it. But I have learned over the years that I have no gift of prophecy in this way. I've had very, very talented undergraduate writers and young and indeed graduate writers who have done nothing that I know of since leaving, my protection. And again and again, I have seen writers whom I would not, if I'd had a gun held to my head, I would not have predicted that they would have would achieve the kind of the art that they have achieved, and the fame and success that they've achieved. So, it's folly to try to predict it. It has everything to do with how willing that young writer is to spend the time and devote himself to this art, and to come back at things again and again and again. One example of this would be Alice Siebold, who was an undergraduate student of mine at Syracuse in the early 80s. She was a perfectly good undergraduate writer. I wouldn't have picked her out of a class to say she's the one, but what Alice did over the years, she left, she took temp jobs, she did all kinds of things, and she kept writing. And every time she'd send me something over the years, it would be better than the last thing she sent me. And she was just absolutely committed to being a good writer, and indeed that's what she became. And I'm very happy to see that others have recognized her as this good writer she's become, and she's a wonderful illustration of the futility of trying to predict the outcome of these ambitions. All you can do is help people as much as possible, and the rest is up to them.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. That was a conversation I recorded with Tobias Wolff earlier this morning. He'll be speaking, or not speaking, he'll be conversing with Pam Houston as part of the California Lectures Series at the Crest Theater a week from Thursday. That's Thursday the 8th of May at 7:30 p.m. I had some hesitation when I first received Our Story Begins, the selected and new stories of Tobias Wolff. I had already interviewed him once a few years ago about Old School, which I think is an absolutely wonderful novel. I didn't know if I should find somebody else rather than sticking with the same authors. But I opened the book at random and read one story called Bullet in the Brain, which I think is as close to a perfect story as I've ever read. The funny thing, the funny connection with this is, not too long ago, I heard a NPR interview, I think it was on Morning Edition, with Tobias Wolff, and the story they had chosen to put in their archive for people who wanted to hear more of his work was Bullet in the Brain. And I happened to look up other recordings of Tobias Wolff's stories, and in the New Yorker, once a month, they have one of their authors pick their favorite story out of everything that the New Yorker has ever published, all the thousands of stories. And T.C. Boyle picked Bullet in the Brain, and we have a recording now of him reading it. If you want to hear the entire discussion, you can go to thenewyorker.com, or you can also go to booktown.blogspot.com, and there'll be a link to the complete recording, because the recording has some introductory material and then about a 5-minute discussion of exactly how the story works at the end. The interview with T.C. Boyle is by Deborah Treisman, who is the fiction editor of The New Yorker, and although it says T. Corgetson Boyle on the written material, she always refers to him as Tom. I think she's one of many thousands of, maybe millions of people in the world who don't really know how to pronounce his middle name. I don't think I got it right. Anyway, here's T.C. Boyle reading Tobias Wolff's Bullet in the Brain.
Anders couldn't get to the bank until just before it closed, so of course the line was endless, and he got stuck behind two women whose loud, stupid conversation put him in a murderous temper. He was never in the best of tempers anyway, Anders. A book critic known for the weary, elegant savagery with which he dispatched almost everything he reviewed. With the line still doubled around the rope, one of the tellers stuck a position closed sign in her window and walked to the back of the bank, where she leaned against a desk and began to pass the time with a man shuffling papers. The women in front of Anders broke off their conversation and watched the teller with hatred. "Oh, that's nice," one of them said. She turned to Anders and added, confident of his accord, "One of those little human touches that keeps us coming back for more." Anders had conceived his own towering hatred of the teller, but he immediately turned it on the presumptuous crybaby in front of him. "Damned unfair," he said. "Tragic, really. If they're not chopping off the wrong leg or bombing your ancestral village, they're closing their positions." She stood her ground. "I didn't say it was tragic," she said. "I just think it's a pretty lousy way to treat your customers." "Unforgivable," Anders said. "Heaven will take note." She sucked in her cheeks, but stared past him and said nothing. Anders saw that the other woman, her friend, was looking in the same direction. And then the tellers stopped what they were doing, and the customers slowly turned, and silence came over the bank. Two men wearing black ski masks and blue business suits were standing to the side of the door. One of them had a pistol pressed against the guard's neck. The guard's eyes were closed, and his lips were moving. The other man had a sawed-off shotgun. "Keep your big mouth shut," the man with the pistol said, though no one had spoken a word. "One of you tellers hits the alarm, you're all dead meat. Got it?" The tellers nodded. "Oh, bravo," Anders said. "Dead meat." He turned to the woman in front of him. "Great script, huh? The stern, brass-knuckled poetry of the dangerous classes." She looked at him with drowning eyes. The man with the shotgun pushed the guard to his knees. He handed the shotgun to his partner and yanked the guard's wrists up behind his back and locked them together with a pair of handcuffs. He toppled him onto the floor with a kick between the shoulder blades. Then he took his shotgun back and went over to the security gate at the end of the counter. He was short and heavy and moved with peculiar slowness, even torpor. "Buzz him in," the partner said. The man with the shotgun opened the gate and sauntered along the line of tellers, handing each of them a hefty bag. When he came to the empty position, he looked over at the man with the pistol, who said, "Whose slot is that?" Anders watched the teller. She put her hand to her throat and turned to the man she'd been talking to. He nodded. "Mine," she said. "Then get your ugly ass in gear and fill that bag." "There you go," Anders said to the woman in front of him. "Justice is done." "Hey, bright boy, did I tell you to talk?" "No," Anders said. "Then shut your trap." "Did you hear that?" Anders said. "Bright boy, right out of the killers." "Please be quiet," the woman said. "Hey, you deaf or what?" The man with the pistol walked over to Anders. He poked the weapon into Anders's gut. "You think I'm playing games?" "No," Anders said. But the barrel tickled like a stiff finger, and he had to fight back the titters. He did this by making himself stare into the man's eyes, which were clearly visible behind the holes in the mask, pale blue and rawly red-rimmed. The man's left eyelid kept twitching. He breathed out a piercing, ammoniac smell that shocked Anders more than anything that had happened, and he was beginning to develop a sense of unease when the man prodded him again with the pistol. "You like me, bright boy? You want to suck my dick?" "No," Anders said. "Then stop looking at me." Anders fixed his gaze on the man's shiny wingtip shoes. "Not down there, up there." He stuck the pistol under Anders' chin and pushed it upward until Anders was looking at the ceiling. Anders had never paid much attention to that part of the bank, a pompous old building with marble floors and counters and pillars and gilt scrollwork over the teller's cages. The domed ceiling had been decorated with mythological figures whose fleshy, toga-draped ugliness Anders had taken in at a glance many years earlier and afterward declined to notice. Now he had no choice but to scrutinize the painter's work. It was even worse than he'd remembered, and all of it executed with the utmost gravity. The artist had a few tricks up his sleeve and used them again and again, a certain rosy blush on the undersides of the clouds, a coy backward glance on the faces of the cupids and fauns. The ceiling was crowded with various dramas, but the one that caught Anders's eye was Zeus and Europa, portrayed in this rendition as a bull ogling a cow from behind a haystack. To make the cow sexy, the painter had canted her hips suggestively and given her long, droopy eyelashes, through which she gazed back at the bull with sultry welcome. The bull wore a smirk, and his eyebrows were arched. If there'd been a bubble coming out of his mouth, it would have said, "Hubba hubba." "What's so funny, bright boy?" "Nothing." "You think I'm comical? You think I'm some kind of clown?" "No." "You think you can f*** with me?" "No." "F*** with me again. Your history, capiche?" Anders burst out laughing. He covered his mouth with both hands and said, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry," then snorted helplessly through his fingers and said, "Capiche? Oh, God, capiche." And at that, the man with the pistol raised the pistol and shot Anders right in the head. The bullet smashed Anders' skull and plowed through his brain and exited behind the right ear, scattering shards of bone into the cerebral cortex, the corpus callosum, back toward the basal ganglia and down into the thalamus. But before all this occurred, the first appearance of the bullet in the cerebrum set off a crackling chain of ion transports and neurotransmissions. Because of their peculiar origin, these traced a peculiar pattern, flukishly calling to life a summer afternoon some 40 years past and long since lost to memory. After striking the cranium, the bullet was moving at 900 feet per second, a pathetically sluggish, glacial pace compared to the synaptic lightning that flashed around it. Once in the brain, that is, the bullet came under the mediation of brain time, which gave Anders plenty of leisure to contemplate the scene that, in a phrase he would have abhorred, passed before his eyes. It is worth noting what Anders did not remember, given what he did remember. He did not remember his first lover, Sherry, or what he had most madly loved about her before it came to irritate him, her unembarrassed carnality, and especially the cordial way she had with his unit, which she called Mr. Mole, as in, "Uh-oh, looks like Mr. Mole wants to play," and, "Let's hide Mr. Mole." Anders did not remember his wife, whom he had also loved before she exhausted him with her predictability, or his daughter, now a sullen professor of economics at Dartmouth. He did not remember standing just outside his daughter's door as she lectured her bear about his naughtiness and described the truly appalling punishments Paws would receive unless he changed his ways. He did not remember a single line of the hundreds of poems he had committed to memory in his youth so that he could give himself the shivers at will. Not "Silent upon a peak in Darien," or "My God, I heard this day," or "All my pretty ones? Did you say all?" Oh, Hellkite, all? None of these did he remember, not one. Anders did not remember his dying mother saying of his father, I should have stabbed him in his sleep. He did not remember Professor Josephs telling his class how Athenian prisoners in Sicily had been released if they could recite Aeschylus, and then reciting Aeschylus himself right there in the Greek. Anders did not remember how his eyes had burned at those sounds. He did not remember the surprise of seeing a college classmate's name on the jacket of a novel not long after they graduated, or the respect he had felt after reading the book. He did not remember the pleasure of giving respect. Nor did Anders remember seeing a woman leap to her death from the building opposite his own just days after his daughter was born. He did not remember shouting, Lord, have mercy! He did not remember deliberately crashing his father's car into a tree or having his ribs kicked in by three policemen at an anti-war rally or waking himself up with laughter. He did not remember when he began to regard the heap of books on his desk with boredom and dread or when he grew angry at writers for writing them. He did not remember when everything began to remind him of something else. This is what he remembered. Heat. A baseball field. Yellow grass, the whir of insects, himself leaning against a tree as the boys of the neighborhood gather for a pickup game. He looks on as the others argue the relative genius of Mantle and Mays. They have been worrying this subject all summer, and it has become tedious to Anders, an oppression like the heat. Then the last two boys arrive, Coyle and a cousin of his from Mississippi. Anders has never met Coyle's cousin before and will never see him again. He says hi with the rest of them, but takes no further notice of him until they've chosen sides and someone asks the cousin what position he wants to play. Shortstop, the boy says. Short's the best position they is. Anders turns and looks at him. He wants to hear Coyle's cousin repeat what he's just said, but he knows better than to ask. The others will think he's being a jerk, ragging the kid for his grammar. But that isn't it, not at all. It's that Anders is strangely roused, elated by those final two words, their pure unexpectedness, and their music. He takes the field in a trance, repeating them to himself. The bullet is already in the brain. It won't be outrun forever or charmed to a halt. In the end, it will do its work and leave the troubled skull behind, dragging its comet's tail of memory and hope and talent and love into the marble hall of commerce. That can't be helped. But for now, Anders can still make time. Time for the shadows to lengthen on the grass. Time for the tethered dog to bark at the flying ball. Time for the boy in right field to smack his sweat-blackened mitt and softly chant, They is. They is. They is.
That was T.C. Boyle, another well-known American novelist and story writer, reading Tobias Wolff's Bullet in the Brain. You can hear an extended version of that with an introduction and discussion of the workings of the story by going to thenewyorker.com, or also I should have this linked by this evening or tomorrow morning. If you go to booktown.blogspot.com, I'll also have a link to that reading. Tobias Wolff will be appearing as part of the California Lecture Series at the Crest Theater a week from Thursday the 8th of May at 7:30 p.m. He'll be in conversation with another notable story writer, Pam Houston. The next writer that I spoke with this morning is about as totally unlike Tobias Wolff as anyone possibly could be. He's the British novelist David Ambrose, who was a television and movie writer until his mid-40s when he started writing fiction, and he's always tried to write fiction with a twist to it, and very unlike Tobias Wolff, who pays little attention to plot or only uses it as far as it's necessary, for Ambrose, as you'll hear, plot is everything. The first book of his, The Man Who Turned Into Himself, has just been reissued in paperback by Picador USA. It was originally published in 1993. Some of his other books since then are Mother of God, The Discreet Charm of Charlie Monk, Coincidence, A Memory of Demons, and so on. I've read none of those, but I quite enjoyed The Man Who Turned Into Himself, and you might as well. Anyway, this is what David Ambrose had to say a couple of hours ago.
How did you get the idea for The Man Who Turned Into Himself?
Well, very often I find that an idea for a novel comes from two or three places at once. I've long been fascinated in theoretical physics, particularly the notion of the multiverse, the multiple realities all wrapped into each other. And then another of my great fascinations, a related thing, has always been human identity. We have such a sense of the singularity and the individuality, uniqueness of our own identity. And when that uniqueness, that sense of individuality begins to disintegrate, it's a very interesting and frightening experience. So those sort of thoughts, because of course all literature basically is about human experience, not just about ideas. So that combination of the experience of identity breakdown and the possible multiple reality that exists in the universe came together in this story.
In the story, just for our listeners' sake, a young publisher named Rick Hamilton is suddenly convinced that his wife is about to die in an accident. He rushes to the spot, sees her die, saves his son, but then finds himself transported to a parallel universe where he is Richard Hamilton, his wife is still alive, and he never had a son. And the two characters, Rick and Richard Hamilton, interact for the next rest of the book.
Yes. I mean, I think we should make the point that this is the story is based on some pretty interesting intellectual ideas, but it's not a heavy read. It's very much a thriller full of major surprises. I love surprises when I'm reading, and I try to deliver them when I'm writing. But I do enjoy playing around with metaphysical notions and the concepts, you know, the concept of what is a personality, what do we mean when we say I, and that sort of thing.
I would say from looking at this book and the others of yours I've seen, the themes are somewhat like those of the science fiction writers Philip K. Dick, but you don't have a paranoid-inducing organization or hugely powerful person creating these mix-ups of personality. They seem to be happening in more natural ways.
Well, in fact, my books have often been compared to Philip K. Dick's, and that's a comparison which I find hugely flattering. I didn't consciously model myself on him, but I realize, in fact, that a lot of my preoccupations were also his.
I guess the difference is I love his books and I find them incredibly stimulating, but never quite believable. The larger-than-life business people or the government organizations seem made up for the purpose of messing with everybody's minds, where in yours, everything is much more plausible.
Yes, Philip K. Dick does deal more in caricature, it's true. A very important part of what I'm trying to do is to create extremely disturbing events in an entirely believable world. I don't like the sort of science fiction, even though, in fact, years ago I used to work on Star Trek with the great Gene Roddenberry, and I think Star Trek is a wonderful show. But I've never wanted to write the kind of science fiction not in the novel form, which involves space travel and rocket ships and so forth. I rather prefer something that one finds in some of the great classic ghost stories, the idea of setting a story in an absolutely recognizable here and now and leading the reader by the hand up a garden path where every step is completely logical and you know exactly where you're going until suddenly you find yourself in a place and you look around and say, how in the name of all heaven did I get here?
There's a quote from another interview I've read with you where you say, "At the end, I'm trying to mess with the reader's brain in a way that most thrillers don't. I tend to tell Frankenstein stories. Sod life-affirming. I've done that in Hollywood. I want them to say, he writes mind-blowing books."
Well, yes, this is true. The nice thing about writing your own books is that you can write pretty much exactly what you want, rather than having to please a committee of executives and so forth. Not to knock Hollywood too hard, but you are writing within constraints there. When I started to write novels, which was fairly late in my career, really, I was well into my 40s, having had a long history of writing films and television, and indeed for the stage earlier on. But the great thing I discovered writing my novels was that all the things which fascinated me, as it were, as a hobby more than anything else, suddenly came bubbling to the forefront and were the material that I found I was writing with.
So in a way, it's a reaction against your film and television work.
It's a reaction against, in some ways, and it's also a celebration of a freedom, the kind of freedom you can only have as a novelist or possibly a poet, which I'm not. But it's the ability to write exactly what you want and to explore precisely what you find most fascinating in the world around you.
And you do it in a very matter-of-fact, low-key manner. I had just been reading a well-known short story writer and then turned to the man who turned it into himself and was at first a little disappointed by the flatness of the language. And it was only after I was maybe 30 pages in that it really began to catch me, and I realized that the matter-of-factness and flatness was in a way, well, it made everything more realistic and more believable, and there was none of the poetic effects that I'd been reading several days before.
I hope the language isn't too flat, but it's perfectly true that I avoid attempting poetic effects because that's not the way I want to mess with people's minds. As I say, I want to create a sense of absolute reality, a world which they recognize and feel at home in, and then begin to distort it to an extent that will undermine their sense of self, their sense of all the certainties they take for granted. It's a subversive kind of thing, in a way, but I think that's what, certainly it's what I'm trying to do with fiction. I think is what some of the most exciting fiction I've read also does.
In The Man Who Turned Into Himself, there are four main characters, each of which appears in a very different aspect to the other three through the book, and the part of the excitement of the book is the way that one character will suddenly take over and then another one will, and they will completely change the way you perceive them and the way you perceive their world.
Yes, well, to an extent this reflects what I'm talking about, that all reality is perceived, you know, we're all the center of our own universe. That's already just taking all the people on Earth alone. That's an awful lot of universes side by side. In a sense, it reflects this notion of, you know, the multiverse, the parallel universe theory of reality. So yes, I do try to get into that part of a person's head, which is where they use the term I, and try to figure out, you know, how we use the term, each one of us, how we use the term I, what we mean by it, and what it means to us, what we mean when we say I.
And at some point, the characters, Rick and Richard, don't really know which of them is determining what they're doing.
Well, this is the thing, when you find that you yourself are inhabiting two different worlds, similar but different worlds, but yourself.
Do you still do television and film work, or have you switched mostly to novel writing?
I still do some, but I've switched mostly to novel writing. I've recently, in England, been adapting one of my novels called Mother of God into a television series. I've just finished a pilot for a series, and that is about artificial intelligence. That is a story of an artificial intelligence which escapes from an isolated computer, which is actually nice, it would be dangerous if they get out. Well, this is the story of one of these very advanced artificial intelligences, a thing called a singularity, that actually does escape onto the internet, as a result of which the internet becomes conscious, becomes a giant brain. If the internet becomes a thinking thing, rather like the human brain, the internet becomes a thing with its own identity and able to use the word I about what it wants and what it feels and so on and so forth.
I have looked through that book but not read it, but I would imagine if you have some of the same concerns as in The Man Who Turned Into Himself, the internet would start to think about itself as I, but then begin to wonder, who am I?
Well, it does all of those things. And of course it has overwhelming access to overwhelming power. It can get into and control all communication systems, including all weapons systems. It can manipulate economies. It can spy on everybody or anything. It is, in fact, that is why the title of the book is Mother of God, because essentially it is a god that mankind has created. Effectively, it has the powers of a god. I've renamed it for the television series. I've renamed it Brainchild, but that's just because of some of the slight difference in focus that it requires to rethink it as a television series as opposed to a one-off story. But in answer to your question, I'm still writing novels. I'm rather late with a new one, but I'm working on it now.
And that is?
Oh, the one I'm working on now is actually a psychological thriller and doesn't have any metaphysical aspects at all, but it does have one or two mind-bending surprises, I hope, as it goes along. In other words, the reality I write about always tends to be the kind of reality that suddenly becomes something else. It is the moment we take any reality for granted, it tends to evolve into something quite different or simply disappear and is replaced by something else and possibly more alarming.
And what is it called and when will it be out?
The new one is called Twisted, and when it's going to be out, I have no idea, because first of all, I got to finish it, and then it goes through whatever all the hoops are that a book goes through before it's out.
When you write a book that has as many twists as your books normally do, do you have to plot them out carefully in advance, or do you sort of sit back and see what happens?
No, I plot very carefully in advance. That's partly, probably, a legacy of my time as a screenwriter and playwright. I find I have to construct in great detail before I start writing. I'll sometimes do 30 or 40 or more versions of an outline, and then, only then, start writing. And it becomes a sort of trial of strength between the writing and the structure. If the writing overwhelms the structure in the sense that your imagination starts to run away with you at a certain part and the structure can't take it, then you have to rethink the structure. But I've never really had a problem with that. Once I've got a structure worked out, I tend to be able to stay with it and simply flesh it out to whatever extent I can as I go along.
That was English novelist and earlier film and TV writer David Ambrose. His first novel from 1993, The Man Who Turned Into Himself, has just been reissued by Picator Books. Earlier in the program, I talked to Tobias Wolff about his stories. Our Story Begins is the title of his selected and new stories, which has just been published by A.A. Knopf. He'll be appearing at the Crest Theater at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday the 8th in conversation with Pam Houston as part of the California Lecture Series. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM. I'm Eric Tome. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party.